Welcome back to Cloak and Dagger. I'm your host, Lenny Bloom, along with my co-host, Sherman Skolnick, the great American Judge Buster. Sherman is recuperating. He'll be back in a week or two, he says. We're looking forward to his return. In the meantime, we're joined by our regular guest, Ralph Schoenemann. Ralph, we're here once again to expose the state secrets the ruling elite hope you don't learn. And welcome you back with your treasury of wisdom and knowledge to update us. It's a pleasure to have you back here at Cloak and Dagger.
Thank you, Lenny. Good to be with you. I was mentioning to you that in today's Canadian,
yes,
there's an important article, a report by John Stokes, that discloses new studies that have documented over 250,000 Iraqi civilian deaths directly consequential upon the invasion and the death squad operations that are being waged, and that's just with respect to the firepower. Now, I mean, if we look at that, you know, it's roughly the equivalent of about 3.2 million U.S. citizens proportionate to population.
Right.
And of course, the 250,000 deaths that are the result of these vast saturation bombing attacks and this constant war on the civilian population is not inclusive of the results of the chemical and biological weapons that have been deployed in Iraq. You were mentioning Lauren Murray's important work on depleted uranium. Well, depleted uranium has impacted Iraq in so devastating a fashion that there has been an epidemic of thalidomide-like birth deformities across Iraq. And, of course, that's compounded by the destruction of hospitals and the civilian infrastructure. And, of course, the United States has used an array of radiological weapons, particularly in Fallujah. One of the reasons that they've been killing journalists and tried to assassinate the Italian journalist, if you recall, when the security officer from Italy, after she'd been putatively kidnapped, was killed throwing his body across her when she was ambushed, Negroponte having set that up. One of the reasons for that is that they were investigating in Fallujah this omnipresence of American bulldozers, U.S. Army bulldozers, taking away all the earth, because the radiological radiation of presence in the earth was indicative of the types of essentially their tactical, like nuclear weapons, that have been deployed and experimented on in across Iraq. So the 250,000 doesn't begin to talk or to describe the generations long impact of this weaponry.
Yeah.
Now, all of that is fueling this almost entirely national uprising in Iraq. And that really brings us to the question of what is behind the bombing of the Samarra Golden Dome Mosque.
Yes.
The Shia Shrine, which, to place it in the context that we can see very clearly, it's the equivalent of Protestants deciding to blow up St. Peter's Cathedral. One has to keep in mind that the Sunni population, you're talking about 20% minority in Iraq, and in Samarra, the 1,500-year-old mosque was a cultural landmark for all Muslims. It wasn't just a Shia holy shrine. The likelihood that the Sunni would target the Golden Mosque in Samarra is highly minimal. And there's an important article today in which the former CIA analyst and presidential advisor Ray McGovern maintains that, in fact, it's the U.S. intelligence special forces that are responsible for the bombing. Now, McGovern was a senior analyst for the Vice President, Secretary of State, and Secretary of Defense, and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs. When he makes that kind of statement, it comes out of some knowledge and some authoritative knowledge of the way these operations are conducted. Of course, it could be claimed that the United States would not want to initiate a disintegrating civil war in Iraq. But what they do want to do is, they've always sought to fragment the country and to break it up into components, what they do want to do is to have the resistance turn upon itself. And what they call civil war is essentially to have the Shia and Sunni populations engaged not in resisting the occupation, but in killing each other. And this is not the first time that the strategy of setting people against each other in this way has been deployed in, of course, not just in the Middle East, but across the world, but in particular in the Middle East, between countries and within countries. Top ranks of the intelligence apparatus has been, as McGovern describes it, involved in this process, and there's a whole series of U.S. death squads that have been operating in Iraq. The intelligentsia has been kidnapped, murdered, disappeared. This is a war on the Iraqi people. One other dimension of this that emerges in relation to the Golden Mosque bombing is that the evidence is massive from the ministers in the top of the Iraqi government itself that Yahoo News reported yesterday that the bombing was a specialist job, according to the construction minister Yassim Mohammed Jaffer, that the explosives were planted over a period of 12 hours. And the charges were connected together and linked to remote charges, and then charges placed just under the dome. The wires linked to detonators, which were then triggered at the remote distance. To drill into the pillars required 4 hours per pillar. Now, this is a security-surrounded area. This is quite an elaborate operation to be carried through with U.S. security forces in the proximity.
Uh-huh.
The dome was completely wrecked, collapsed on the tombs, covered by debris. The shrine's foundations were detonated. 40% of the power of the blast was directed inwards. That's a very sophisticated and specific operation. Frankly, what really comes to light, and there's been a number of reports about this, is that this is the classic model of operation that the Mossad has used in Lebanon and in other arenas. And the Mossad has been omnipresent in Iraq as it has been in Iran. That takes us back to what we've described so often in our program Taking Aim, in which I set forth in my book The Hidden History of Zionism, namely the report of Oded Yinon in 1979 called A Strategy for the 1980s that called for the fragmentation of each Middle Eastern country into its ethnic and religious components to facilitate the decomposition of these states and their conquest. There's another report on the bombing. The night before the bombing, two eyewitnesses. And in this report, these are first-hand reports that emerge out of Iraq. There are photographs showing people actually involved in wiring the dome. So, the mosque guard's testimony stated that four people with Iraqi National Guard uniforms blindfolded them and then proceeded with impunity, because there were other Iraqi National Guards around, to wire the mosque. So, and a second eyewitness gave more detailed information. Mohammed Ali Samarai, who owns an internet cafe adjacent to the mosque, describes how joint forces of Iraqi National Guard and U.S. Special Forces moved into the area, told him to remain in his shop, not to leave the shop. They came back and began to patrol the area very carefully, keeping all others out. And as that process was going, the wiring was unfolding.
Right, right.
At 6 o'clock the next morning, the ING leaves the area. 6:30, the U.S. Special Forces leave the area. 6:40, the first explosion occurs. 6:45, the second explosion occurs. You are talking here about very concrete eyewitness testimony as to the dynamics of this bomb.
Right, right.
And as I mentioned, apart from the eyewitnesses, the Iraqi National Guard is completely Pentagon controlled.
Yes, yeah.
And this is not a sovereign national operation.
Of course not.
Special forces of the United States authorities.
It's just a costume. It's just another one of their costumes.
Yes, very much so. And then yet another report on the 23rd of February. This is very instructive, that there was a Council on Foreign Relations backgrounder, which describes how the Iraqi National Guard has to be put in place of the Iraqi Civil Defense Corps as the prevalent security force in Iraq. And the World Tribune describes it as a 45,000-member special force trained by the United States with Britain and Jordan for special operations. So the it's no surprise that this is the unit that's in the, surrounding the dome, telling people in adjacent booths, stay there, don't move, stay inside, don't come out.
Right.
And then sending others away, and then the timing with them present. You know, they leave at 6:30, and at 6:40 the bombing, the bombs detonate.
Right.
In one location, 6:45 in the next location. I think we are fairly
sophisticated to understand. Yeah. We've been able to, you've connected the dots on that one, Ralph, and the pattern is obvious.
And I wanted to mention, Lenny, that, there's more to say about the mosque bombing, but what is unfolding here is an operation that was preceded by something that we reported at great length, namely the British Special Forces operation that was being carried out in Basra. Because to remind our listeners, this goes back to last September, when the Basra police caught a car with what appeared to be people in Shia Muslim garb, and they turned out to be British SAS operators.
Right.
British Special Forces. And the car was loaded up with detonation, with high explosives, and they were heading for the main square of Basra, which is the main market with a concentration of the civilian population. This is the Shia area. And it is a similar sort of operation, and the Iraqi police, who were puppet police after all, tried to detain this car, several of them were shot dead. And after that, the Iraqi police went into the city and called on the population. They called on the population to come to their aid, and tens of thousands of people came to the area. And now these special forces operatives who were caught red-handed with the explosives headed for the main square are put into a prison holding place by the Iraqi police. Whereupon the British send in a whole series of armored carriers and tanks, literally mow down the retaining wall of this detention area prison and the building itself, and take out the soldiers, the SAS operatives. This was an instance in which what would have undoubtedly been described in the international media as a suicide mission, no doubt ascribed to al-Zarqawi or Abercrombie McFusnick, for that matter, was an operation of British Special Forces themselves targeting. It would have caused literally thousands of injuries and deaths because of the magnitude of the explosives and the location in which it was going to, they were going to be detonated. Same operation in scale and type, and the same objective, which was to create a civil strife between the religious, the Sunni and Shia populations. And it goes to another question, Lenny, which I think is important, because bear in mind that one of the problems that they have with their targeting of Iran, and that's, I mean, every newspaper in the world has now, in the past 6 weeks, been replete with the detailed information about how the bombing of Iran is now on a timetable. It's going to unfold between March and April, and that the scale of the bombing will be immense, and the tactical nuclear weapons may well be employed, and all of that.
Yeah.
Well, the prospect of an attack on Iran of this magnitude is that throughout the Middle East, whether in Shia areas of the Middle East or Sunni, the populations will be mobilized in support of the Iranian people after such an attack. One of the consequences of attempting to induce a bloodletting and internecide rage between Sunni and Shia is to mute the response of the Sunni populated countries of Egypt and Jordan and Lebanon and other dominant Sunni dominant areas of the Middle East to the pending attack on Shia Iran. So I think we have to see this is a classic type of false flag operation, divide and rule operation that we're long familiar with, and that I think is the dynamic that is unfolding here.
This is it's the same modus operandi the British have been using there for decades, divide and conquer.
Centuries, that's right.
Yes,
now,
centuries.
But in this regard, you know, Lenny, I think in the time we have, I wanted to also make some a comment, or if you like, a report on the port operation.
Yes, please.
An Oriental Steam Navigation Company of Great Britain that was purchased by DP World, which is owned by Dubai's Royal Maktoum family, about which so much has been made. What hasn't been disclosed is that the British ownership of this was nominal. I mean by that, when they call it British ownership, well, the Saudis have a large percentage of that, but there are particular relationships between this Dubai company and the Bush administration. The Treasury Secretary, John Snow, was Treasury of CSX Rail, which sold its international port operations to Dubai Port World for $1.15 billion. In other words, this is the same old crony capitalism, just like Osama bin Laden's father and brother were the principal investors in George Bush's Arbusto.
Yes.
And they're talking about 21 ports that are going to be administered by the DP World. Well, the profiteering that is involved in this involves Bush's cabinet, his Treasury Secretary, as well as David Sanborn, who is the Dubai DP World Company's European and Latin American Director of Operations, and the head of the U.S. Maritime Administration for George Bush. So this is an operation that has to do with, yes, the United Arab Emirates are being demonized because they're Arabs, but that racist and anti-immigrant and nonsense is designed, of course, to fuel and the what can I call it, the fake rationale of the category of terror. And that's why this outcry by the Democrats about this is so ludicrous, because they're saying they're invoking the specter of terrorism as emanating from the control of port operations in 21 ports, 22 ports, by this DP world. But what we're really talking about is the Bush, the American ruling class itself, which is involved up to its eyeballs in this, and $1.15 billion. It's not quite chump change, but it greases the wheels rather nicely for these people. And it's their operation. It's their operation. And the ties of the White House to the Dubai firm have been now widely reported in the New York Daily News on February 21st. They go even further.
You're saying the real stakeholders, the owners of this company that picked up this contract, are really basically American, sovereign American owners?
Yeah, I mean, here, this is the New York Daily News. Treasury Secretary John Snow, whose agency heads the federal panel, signed off on a $6.8 billion sale of the English company the government owned, Dubai Ports. Well, he was chairman, as I mentioned, and the article confirms, of CSX Rail, that got $1.15 billion out of this operation. I mean, so, yes, this is the classic example of crony capitalism at work, and it's basically posturing from Congress from the right about the presumptive, quote, security, unquote, issues that are involved here. And a lot of this also obscures the fact that this security issue is being invoked demagogically to create the rationale for controlling who works in the ports, for policing them, for preventing them from striking, from preventing them from protesting the contracts that eliminate their benefits. It's a police operation against the workers who work in the ports. It's part of also the process of privatization. Privatization is about union busting. Privatization is about attacking the health benefits and pension rights and the gains that workers have made. And it's all done under the rubric, we're at war, there's a national security issue. None of these, you can't disrupt the security of the port by fighting for better conditions, let alone going on strike.
Well, Ralph, were the ports in the past controlled by the Teamsters? The docks? Who controlled the docks?
Well, no, the Teamsters, or it's the longshore workers.
The longshore, that's it.
The ILWU on the west coast of the United States and the ILA on the east coast of the United States, they don't control the docks. Their workers are members of those unions. And what the unions represent are the interests of the workers for job security, for pensions, for safety and for health. It's interesting that one stevedoring company that filed a lawsuit on February 10th in federal court to block the takeover did so on the grounds that the DP World takeover would, quote, endanger the national security of the United States. But in fact, the reality is that this is a completely bogus issue, and what is involved here is competition amongst private companies for who gets the deal.
Uh-huh.
And the deal is being cut for the Bush cronies, who are getting billions of dollars of profit out of this particular company as opposed to another particular company being the instrument for the port operation. You know, one of the interesting things, too, is that some of the members of Congress, for the first time, have said it would appear, I'm looking for the precise quotation, but it's rather instructive, it would appear, they say, that the question of national security and the issue of terror is nothing more than a pretext for money making money, and for silencing anybody who would criticize it. Now that raises the obvious question of the whole nature of 9/11 itself, because that's what this is really touching. The invocation of the category of terror and the prospect that there's this demonized force out there ready to strike as a rationale for the militarization of the society, the creation of martial law conditions, the unquestioned long war that entails permanent war against country after country. You have rhetoric about a terrorist organization can need to find, I'm quoting, a single weak link within a trusted shippers company complex, to such as a poorly paid truck driver taking a container from a remote factory to a port and gain access into the container to jeopardize security. All of that is demagogic nonsense. So that those are in essence the that's the dirty secret behind the so-called security scandal. Pamela Hess in the United Press International makes the same basic point. It's interesting that in this instance, the mainstream press has not fallen into lockstep over this. The Bush administration has approved the takeover of British-owned Peninsula Oriental Steam Navigation Company to DP World, they go on, and she invokes the money that was made by Snow. And the Bush administration officials are very much on the defensive about this. But again, the critique from the Democrats is strictly from the right, that it jeopardizes national security because the company is based in Dubai, which is, of course, a red herring here and not the critical question at all in this particular. And there's a particularly incestuous timeline because CSX and John Snow go back to the Bush family and to the Carlyle Group as well. And John Snow was deeply involved with James Baker, senior partner Baker Botts, which is the legal firm very active in facilitating all these arrangements for Halliburton and for Carlyle and for Kellogg Brown and Root. Same kind of operations that they're doing in the Emirates, they're doing in Egypt and Kuwait. So this is the kleptocracy of a decaying capitalism using the specter of a terror apparatus. The terrorists will get us. The terrorists will get us as a rationale for grotesque profiteering and using the state as their vehicle. Just to give you a little bit of this, what we could call Bakerberg.
Yeah, we got about 5 minutes. Go ahead, you've got time.
Okay. James Baker was senior counsel, not just to the Carlyle Group, but to Aerostructures Corporation, Combined Tactical Systems, Inc., DHS Technologies, Landmark Aviation, the Stellex Aerostructures, Inc., Vought Aircraft Industries, Canada's Standard Aero Holdings, Inc., Italy's Avio S.P.A., U.S. British Firth Rickson Limited, British NP Aerospace, and the recently privatized Kineti Q. So it's a global capitalist operation with Baker and the Bushes at the center and the Carlyle Group with their, it's a $14 billion defense military contracting operation, and their sway over U.S. policy, foreign and domestic, is dependent upon their links to all of this in the Middle East, and they are up to their eyeballs in their relationship with the bin Ladens and Khalid bin Mahfouz and the BCCI banking that sustained Bush in his entry into the oil business in the first place. That's what we're really dealing with here. And by the way, one point further on this.
Yep.
It ain't just Baker and Bush, because one of the other players in this is Madeleine Halfbright, who as Clinton's Secretary of State, heads up the call it by its correct name, the Albright Group, which is a consortium tied into the government of Kuwait and in direct collusion with Carlyle.
Right.
So when you look at the structure of capital and you see how the state is deployed as their basically as their milk cow, and you see how they play out their hand by using the military force of the state to conquer resources and to conquer countries and to grab oil and to subjugate populations, that's the real meaning of the war on terror. A decaying capitalist state apparatus that needs permanent war, deepening exploitation, and terrorizes the peoples of the world in that pursuit. I would say that when you look at the so-called port scandal and you connect the dots and you scrape away, as you like to say, you scrape away the bullshit, what emerges is the same old, same old. That's what we're dealing with.
Yeah. Ralph, it's been great having you on here. Listen, are they still on, before you go, are they still on track, do you figure, for bombing runs in Iran sometime next month?
I think that's very much the, you know, they set us up for it. They prepared the ground for it. It's very much in the cards. That whether they choose to do it at a given conjuncture or not, I mean, you know, I don't want to make a firm and fast prediction. They've been preparing the ground to do just exactly that. The question of attacking Iran and using a military operation in Iran is certainly clearly what they have in their minds to do. We'll see how it plays out. If it isn't Iran, it'll be somewhere else.
Yeah.
But they need permanent war. They need permanent crisis.
Yeah.
One of the things that ties into this, as you and I have talked about so often, Lenny, is that in order to really put this over, they're going to have to stage some kind of operation. Now, it'll be a spectacular thing like the blowing up of the Golden Mosque. Where it happens remains to be seen. I mean, it could be anywhere from Houston, Texas, to Washington, D.C., to Toronto, Canada, to you name it. But that they will stage another terror operation as a false flag operation, like the blowing up of the mosque, you can be sure is on their agenda.
Yeah, yeah. And the patsies are being prepared and made ready so that at the time the operation goes on, they can trout out the Oswalds, the patsies, and make the people think that the patsies are the ones to blame and behind it.
Yeah, they'll find some enemy combatant or I forgot the term, Lenny, but...
Round up the usual patsies.
Well, I wasn't even thinking so much as that, but when you're trying to get extras to come on a set for a movie...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
yeah, an extra, a call for extras from the casting agency.
Call for extras, come on.
Yeah.
Costumes, everybody.
Yeah, that's right, costumes, that's right. The William Morris Agency.
Right.
Well, Ralph, it's create the disease in order to offer the cure, and the patsies will be all ready. Tell me, Ralph, before you go, everything seems to go back, of course, and link to Dallas. There's always some character in some operation, even today, that's linked somewhere back to something to do with the JFK Dallas. What's going on with the Mr. Super Bullet theory, Mr. the senator Arlen Specter?
Because Joan Mellon was on C-SPAN today. Last night at 11 o'clock Eastern, 8 o'clock Western time on national television with her presentation in New York to the Society for Ethical Culture on her book, A Farewell to Justice. One of the things that Joan was doing was talking about how the Kennedy execution is the platform, the
template,
defining event, which allows for the such things as 9/11. Because when you actually murder the head of state and succeed at it and effect a treasonous coup, it's treason at the top, everything flows from that. And an interesting aspect of this is that in the current issue of The Nation magazine, I should say in the last issue of The Nation magazine, a CIA media asset named Max Holland and one of his close working colleagues, who is a miserable little creature named Paul Mitchinson, who's the writer for the National Post in Canada, have been, who basically are what I call pimps for the Imperium. They are promoting the thesis everywhere that the work of Jim Garrison and my work and Joan Mellon's work were really on behalf of the KGB. The KGB is responsible for the thesis that the Kennedy assassination was the work of the Central Intelligence Agency. They arrive at that out of the view that the investigation that was conducted by the Italian newspaper Paese Sera was the handiwork of the KGB, which is a disinformation story that has its origins in, with Richard Helms.
Uh-huh.
Now, as Joan pointed out in her talk today, one of the people who was key in advancing this thesis with Max Holland and was a person named Philip Zelikow, who was a colleague of Holland's at the Miller Institute, and he wrote into the prominent ruling class publication Foreign Affairs to sustain these libelous charges.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that came out of this is that since they mentioned that Mark Lane, whose book Rush to Judgment on the Kennedy Assassination, as it was written in my flat in London, they said that too was funded by the KGB, and they did this in the pages of The Nation. So Mark has filed a lawsuit against The Nation, against Max Holland, and they've had to publish an 1,800-word letter from Mark Lane, and a letter from myself, and a letter from Joan Mellon. And one of the points that we make is that Mr. Zelikow was the head of the 9/11 commission.
Oh, you're kidding.
And not only was he, in fact, if we have the time, Lenny,
yes,
it might be interesting just to run down some of the elements of this.
Let's go into it. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, what I wanted to, here's what I'm going to do. Dear editor, Max Holland has engaged for years in propagating calculated disinformation on behalf of the Central Intelligence Agency concerning the investigation of its role in the official execution of John F. Kennedy. His writing and byline on the subject appear on the CIA's official website. In The Nation on February 20th, Mr. Holland expatiates upon his fabricated thesis that Jim Garrison's evidence concerning the CIA's role in the Kennedy murder derived from a series of articles in Paese Sera in 1967. I sent those articles to Jim Garrison in my capacity as director of the Who Killed Kennedy Committee in London, whose members and supporters included Bertrand Russell, Professor Hugh Trevor Roper, Arnold Toynbee, Field Marshal Sir Claude Auchinleck, Lord Boyd Orr, amongst prominent others. The Bertrand Russell Peace Foundation, of which I was then executive director, had conducted an extended investigation and political campaign regarding the role of the CIA in brutal repression, political imprisonment, and attacks on dissidents and worker leaders in Greece. Our Save Greece Now committee unearthed concrete data regarding the role of the CIA that helped mobilize the movement for which Deputy Grigoris Lambrakis paid with his life. In the aftermath, our committee and its Greek leader, Michael Peristyrakis, led a demonstration of over 1 million that brought down the repressive regime. It was these issues and concerns that prompted Paese Sera, a newspaper of the independent left, to undertake a 6-month investigation into the role of the CIA in Italy, its ties to the Mussolini holdovers in Italian military intelligence and their preparations for a military coup. The incubating CIA colonel's coup in Greece would unfold shortly after the prescient Paesi Serra series was printed with ominous implications for all of Europe. The London and Paris correspondent of Paesi Serra was in contact with us with regard to this inquiry, and prominent writers and intellectuals of the Italian and European left shared these concerns, even as they supported Paesi Serra, including Rosanna Rosandra, K.S. Carroll, Lelio Basso, Bertrand Russell, Jean-Paul Sartre, and Simone de Beauvoir. The focus of this investigation was entirely unrelated to events in the United States or the assassination of John F. Kennedy. It was fortuitous, if of great moment, that the CIA proprietary front organizations in Italy that emerged in relation to CIA plans to overthrow the Italian government included Central Mondiale Commerciale and Permanent Industrial Expositions, Permindex, of which Clay Shaw was a director in New Orleans. Jim Garrison was well on the trail of Clay Shaw and his role as a CIA handler of Lee Harvey Oswald before the investigative series in Paesi Serra. When I sent the series of articles to Jim Garrison, he had already charged Clay Shaw in relation to the murder of Kennedy. Jim found the Paesi Serra series confirmatory and important, but the articles were not admissible as evidence in court, however significant their import. Mr. Holland has written repeatedly that Paesi Serra was a communist newspaper and a conduit for KGB disinformation. In fact, Paesi Serra was not the newspaper of the Italian Communist Party. That was Unita. Paesi Serra was a newspaper not unlike The Nation before Mr. Holland's infiltration of the latter as a contributing editor, with the exception that Paesi Serra was less inclined to defend the leaders of the Soviet Union than was The Nation during the decades since the 1930s. The KGB fiction with regard to Paesi Serra, and notably with respect to Jim Garrison's investigation, is real intelligence disinformation, but it arises not from the KGB, but from a directive of Richard Helms to CIA media assets like Mr. Holland, quote, how to respond to critics of the Warren Report, unquote, April 7, 1967. It should be noted that what emerged from the important investigative work on which the Bertrand Russell Peace Foundation and Paesi Serra collaborated at that time was the full evidence of the 40-year campaign of the CIA in Italy, now known as Operation Gladio. Operation Gladio entailed the carrying out of a campaign of terror that included the kidnapping and murder of Prime Minister Aldo Moro, the bombing of the Bologna rail station in 1984, events that were carried out by P2 of Italian intelligence under the direction of the CIA and imputed to the Red Brigades, the Communist Party, and the student left. Note the puppet masters, the political use of terrorism in Italy by Philip Willan, and NATO secret armies, Operation Gladio and Terrorism in Western Europe by Daniel Ganzer, as well as the series of broadcasts on Taking Aim and WBAI, of which Maya Schoen and I are co-producers. I worked with Jim Garrison for 20 years and sent him many documents, including Secret Service Report 767 that cites Alan Sweat, chief of the criminal division of the Dallas Sheriff's Office, disclosure of Lee Harvey Oswald's FBI informant number S172, and Dallas District Attorney Henry Wade's citation of Oswald's CIA number 110669. Mr. Holland asserts that Mark Lane's Rush to Judgment was funded by the KGB. That book was written in my flat in London. The Bertrand Russell Peace Foundation brought Mark Lane to London and supported his work. The largest contribution that Mark Lane or the foundation ever received for these efforts was $42 from Woody Allen. The source of this disinformation promoted by Mr. Holland is The Sword and the Shield, the Matrokin Archive, and the Secret History of the KGB by Christopher Andrew and Vasily Matrokin. The book is a farrago of disinformation without a scintilla of factual or documentary basis, and promotes the actionable slander orchestrated by Mr. Holland, now in the Nation, that Mark Book and his book were funded by the KGB. Mr. Andrew is a lecturer for the CIA, and Mr. Matrokin defected from the KGB at the instigation of that organization. Finally, Philip Zelikow, National Security Advisor to both Bush administrations, a member of President Bush's transition team for the National Security Council, and appointed by George W. Bush to his Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board immediately after the September 11, 2001 attacks, has endorsed Mr. Holland's specious charges in foreign affairs, even as he and Mr. Holland were working colleagues in the Miller Institute. Mr. Zelikow, as head of the 9/11 Commission, has been the point man in covering up the role of U.S. intelligence in the planning and implementation of the events of September 11th. It is fitting that the very individuals who protect the treason at the top that defines the official assassination of President Kennedy are performing that role in relation to events of 9/11, a precise correlative to Operation Gladio, whose elements were first exposed by the investigative work of Paisi Serra that provided the link of the CIA murder apparatus in Italy to that which murdered the head of state in America. Mr. Holland seeks to present the investigators into official murder in the United States not as people of principle and daring, but as disinformation tools of an intelligence service. When it comes to being a pimp for the Imperium, Mr. Holland, physician, heal thyself. You give hypocrisy a bad name, and you soil the nation in the process. That's the letter.
And terrific letter, Ralph. Excellent. It really highlights and points out for anybody who's been a student of the Kennedy assassination for all these years like I have been, it really brings to the surface exactly what's going on backstage with these criminals, crooks, and lowlifes.
Thanks, Lenny. I'm pleased to say it's going to be in the Nation. I think that has been a little bit influenced by the fact that Ark later filed a lawsuit against the editor of the Nation and Max Holland as well, to which I'm conjoined. So it's hitting the fan right now.
Terrific. Well, happy hunting on that one. Way to go, because thanks to you, even though Garrison's not here, we're staying very close on the heels of the assassins of John Kennedy.
I think so. Thank you, Lenny.
It's been an honor and a real pleasure having you here again. Look forward to your next week's report, Ralph, and your great Anatoly France sign-off.
Yes, mankind will not be free until the last capitalist is strangled in the entrails of the last priest.
Read it yourself instead of asking the government why, because that will cause the propaganda to die. Thanks, Ralph.
Thank you, Lenny. Bye.
When the legend becomes fact, print the legend.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Trusting in the sanity and restraint of the United States is not a strategy, and it is not an option.
We don't need no thought control.
What's a conspiracy notion out there? How much influence do you have? Was it you and your fellow neoconservatives that created the momentum towards overthrowing Saddam Hussein?
Nobody does a thing in this town without our approval.
You both were members of Skull and Bones, a secret society at Yale. What does that tell us?
Not much, because it's a secret.
Is there a secret handshake? Is there a secret code?
I wish there were something secret I could manifest.
322, a secret number?
There are all kinds of secrets.